This will be considerably more free form than this morning, so feel free to ask questions or stop me at any point. When I was in high school, I took a speech class, and we had a segment on after dinner speaking. So this qualifies. And I was told you're always supposed to begin with good stories, you know, in order to get and keep your audience's attention, because it's after dinner and they're likely to want to fall asleep. And after already having heard the sound of my voice for 2 hours this morning, you're much more likely to want to fall asleep. So this is a combination of something I learned when I was young and a ploy to keep you awake. But I had mentioned this morning that there are legends that surround this play in the theater. And let me just run through some of them, because they are fascinating. I had one seminarian who said to me in conversation this afternoon that there was something about this play that made him draw back. And I agreed with him. It is a great piece of work, what I would call a great dramatic poem. But given its subject matter, which is the exploration of evil and the capacity of evil to destroy the human soul, it's appropriate we draw back, and we can only imagine what it must have cost the author to have to put it down on paper. A horrifying vision. And at the same time, maybe for that reason, these stories have sprung up. It may just be that it makes actors and actresses as uneasy as some of us who are watching it, but very peculiar things do happen when this play is done. Here are some of those stories. The legend has been around for centuries in theater circles. I mentioned that theater people will not use the name of the play in a theater. That is, if you are in a theater rehearsing another show and you should mention the play by name or happen to quote a line from it, theater people go mad, and there's a little ritual that you have to go through of literally leaving the theater, knocking, asking to be readmitted, turning around three times. It's a superstitious little superstitious nonsense. But you'll find people are absolutely obsessive about this. No one's quite sure where this... It's called the Macbeth curse, and hence it's always referred to as the Scottish tragedy by theater people. They won't mention it by name. The rumor is that early on in the very first production, that the young boy who played Lady Macbeth, which is almost impossible, we're so far from it, we can't imagine. But of course, women were not permitted on the Elizabethan stage. All the women's roles were played by boys, so that the original Lady Macbeth would have been a young male actor playing the role. But the rumor is he became very sick, and the opening had to be postponed. We can't chronicle that. We can chronicle, however, the first production of the play outside of England. It took place in the Netherlands in the 1630s. And it may be here that the story of the so-called curse started, that it was a famous husband and wife acting team playing Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. And some of you may know the opera Paiacci. This is the Paiacci story. The husband and wife were playing these roles, but the actress was having an affair with the actor playing King Duncan. And on opening night, when Macbeth went off stage to murder Duncan, he murdered Duncan. he actually killed the actor playing Duncan. No, he came back on with the bloody daggers. They continued the scene. His wife, playing Lady Macbeth, grabbed them and ran off stage and found her lover lying dead, and she began screaming, and he rushed off stage, murdered her in the wings, curtain down, end of production. grisly. Yeah, absolutely grisly story. Which, by the way, is the Paiacci story, for those of you that know the opera. It happened. Well, I had heard that story, and I'd heard a number of others. There are some classic stories of, the first production after World War II in England was a production featuring a British actor, Diana Wynyard was her name. She was playing Lady Macbeth. And they had a wonderful lighting effect. This was at Stratford-on-Avon, and they had a long staircase that came from the stage left wings onto the stage directly and then turned at a 90-degree angle and came straight at the audience, if you get the picture. So she had to walk down this descending staircase and then do a complete, coming from the wings, coming downstage, do a 90-degree turn and then come right at the audience. And they had her carrying a single candle. And they had, and it was new at the time, what's called a pin spot, a spotlight that could be made so small that they simply focused on her face and the candlelight in front of it, and all you saw was her face in profile coming down the steps. Then she turned, and all you saw was her face descending in darkness coming toward you. They said the effect was spectacular. But, of course, they'd worked it out because as she was coming down, she couldn't count the steps. She couldn't look down and see what was happening there because she had to keep her eyes on the audience. Well, she practiced it on the set and counted in her head as she came down. And, of course, on opening night, right off the end, missed her turn and broke both her legs. And they said as she was carried off, she was yelling, "But I counted correctly! I counted correctly!" Yes.
Is that where we get the term break a leg?
Break a leg. Yeah. Actually, that comes much, much earlier, but it's oddly appropriate. It's oddly appropriate. There was a production in New York in the 30s by the great American director, Orson Welles, who did, it's called The Voodoo Macbeth. It was one of those updated productions, and he set it on a tropical island. In the West Indies, and Macbeth was a voodoo chieftain. I don't know, some nonsense, but they were trying to come up with a musical score and couldn't get anything that was quite the right effect. And then they noticed there was a drum troupe that was coming, a group of drummers, and the music advisor went to hear them and said, "This is just the effect we need." And they went and asked the troupe if they could hire them and if they would provide the music for the production. They said gladly, and they paid them well, so they stayed on after their tour was over. And they kept working with them, and the man, Virgil Thompson, a very fine American composer, kept saying, it's not quite right. Are you giving me your really good stuff? And they said, no, this is tame. We're not doing the real stuff. And they said, well, that's what we want. No, we can't do that. We can't do that. Well, opening night came and it got good reviews, except there was a reviewer from the Chicago Tribune that just assailed the production, said it was nonsense, it was no good at all, and it was a waste of time and energy and money. Wells, John Houseman, and Virgil Thompson came to the theater the next morning to hear wailing from the basement of the theater, and they went down, and here was the drum troupe just going mad, doing the sort of thing that Thompson had first asked them to do. And they didn't dare interrupt them, and finally stopped. And they said to them, "What were you doing?" And they said, "Chicago critic." Chicago critic. He had attacked them in print as well. The man died on the airplane on the way back to Chicago. Again, unbelievable story. I have to keep repeating from Hamlet, "We defy augury." Okay, this is... anyway, I've heard all these stories. These stories circulate. And I was at the University of Minnesota where I got my bachelor's degree. And I was working in the theater and knew a number of people in the theater, some of whom, friends of mine in graduate school, were working at the Tyrone Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis. It was new, and Dr. Guthrie was still directing there. One of them was going to direct a production of Macbeth that winter at the Theater St. Paul, and went to the old revered British director and said, "Dr. Guthrie, I'm doing a production of Macbeth this winter and wonder if you have any advice." And Guthrie said, "Oh, my dear boy, don't do it." "So what do you mean?" He said, "Don't touch that play. Terrible things happen. Just don't bother with it." And he sort of dismissed him as an old eccentric British gentleman. And they went ahead with it, doing the rehearsals, came to the time of opening, and opening night, the young actor, I knew him quite well, who was playing Macbeth, was very withdrawn. The rest of the cast said it was very curious. They didn't know what was happening, but assumed it was just opening night jitters. During intermission, he didn't speak to anyone. He was in a world of his own. they went out to begin what was their second act. They divided it into two parts, and he had the scene with his wife right before the banquet and gave the line, "It will have blood, they say, blood will have blood," and fell down dead on the stage. They stopped the show, of course. There was his wife, he was married, had young children. His wife had an autopsy, heart failure. For no apparent reason, he'd been in perfect health. When I heard that, I started thinking, oh, you know, this is really, I knew him. And from that point on, I have to admit that even though I don't believe in these things, I've gotten a little touchy when people start joking about it. Some years ago, I was doing a production of Aristophanes' The Birds at the Naval Academy. I'd written my own script and turned all the Greek jokes into Navy jokes and Naval Academy jokes. There was a moment where the bird chorus was flying in, and we'd set up rigged lines from the balcony of the theater, and many of the birds actually flew into the stage. It was very dangerous, and we knew it, and we'd worked through it. And one of the performances late in the run, I had a Marine lieutenant helping to do the rigging, checking the rigging, making sure as the birds flew in, everything was fine. And he went up and was helping. The last one to fly in was a young man in an Air Force uniform singing "Off We Go Into the Wild Blue Yonder." Cheap joke. The midshipmen loved it, of course. So he gets on the ropes, and just as he's going off, the lieutenant is saying to him, "I was teaching my plebes today, and I gave a quiz on Hamlet. It was an easy quiz. I asked them 5 questions, and the answer to every single question was Hamlet. Hamlet, 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 Hamlet." So, and he said, "I had one student who was so stupid he put down Macbeth, 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 put the young man on the ropes, sent him off, the ropes untied, and he fell about 15 feet, smashed onto a chair below, broke his arm in 2 places, broke his jaw, which was wired shut for 10 weeks after that." It's unbelievable. The second personal experience, again, it was a couple years after that, I was doing Thornton Wilder's The Alcestiad, his version of the Alcestis myth, had a student who knew I was touchy about this, and all during rehearsal was running around quoting lines from Macbeth in the theater. And I just kept saying, "It's not funny, it's not funny." Opening night, at the end, their little scene where the fellow playing Apollo comes out and had these small bottles with him, and one of them fell on the stage and broke. The curtain call, this young actor who'd been spouting lines from Macbeth, walked out on stage, and a shard of glass like this went right through his bare foot. It was the ugliest thing I've ever seen. He managed to get off stage and pulled it out, and there was a fountain. Just simply a fountain of blood coming out of his... There was blood everywhere. I brought my car over. I got him in the car. And as he sat there, I was taken to the hospital. As blood was spurting all over my car and all over me, he was saying, "I bet you're not going to talk to me for a while, are you?" I tell these stories in class. The midshipmen are fascinated by them, of course. It was the last time I taught the play, which was about, well, close to 2 years ago. I had told these stories, and they're all going, "Yeah, oh, yeah, sure, yeah, well, tell us another one, yeah, no, no." And so we go through it. The next morning in the Washington Post, they were doing a production of Macbeth at Howard University, final dress rehearsal. They brought in an actor from New York to play the role. And the set had consisted of metal scaffolding, and he was on the top scaffold at the end of the play, final dress rehearsal, and whoosh, off he went, broke his collarbone in 2 places, production canceled, big notice in the Post. Every student brought it in, waving it at me. "Did you see this? Did you see this?" And I said, "No." I said, "I'm the one who was telling you about this yesterday." It's a curiosity. It is a curiosity. It may indeed simply be the fact everyone gets a bit spooked doing this show. It makes one very uneasy. As I said, it makes me uneasy to teach it. I don't teach it as often as the other 3 tragedies. And yet it's certainly one of the great dramatic poems in the language.
Is it possible that the incantations of the witches do actually correspond to black
yes,
magic?
Yes, yes. That is the claim. There are many who claim that Shakespeare actually somewhere found a book on witchcraft and copied, of course he turned it into verse, but may well have copied in some of the witch's incantations some lines from an actual witch's book, which, if is the case, who knows? Maybe something is being pulled. I don't know. We can't know. But there is a long tradition of peculiar accidents associated with this play. And the witches' scenes in particular can be unsettling. As I said, some of those lines may strike us as amusing. At the same time, there is something extremely unpleasant in that vision of these crones. Well, it goes back to the fragmentation I talked about at the beginning, tossing these items into that cauldron. Double, toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble. Over and over and over again. So they're unpleasant words and they make us feel uneasy. Someone else mentioned, I'm just running through some comments and questions that came up this afternoon. The question was raised, could Lady Macbeth be in any way Shakespeare's portrait of Elizabeth I? I would be a bit hesitant to draw a direct parallel, but I would make the following statement. The play was obviously written shortly after the death of Queen Elizabeth. She died in 1603. This was probably written in about 1605. So it would not have been that long after the death. Let me put it this way. There is in the sleepwalking scene the sense of what happens to the mind that knows it has done deliberate wrong. Unlike Macbeth, whose imagination quite literally withers and dies during the course of the play as his soul is corrupted, and he gives it up to the forces of darkness. Lady Macbeth, who begins very practical, a little water clears us of the deed, go wash your hands, it's no big deal, by the end of the play has had the conscience awakened in her. We could almost say that they are opposites in that way. They exchange positions. Macbeth's imagination and conscience dwindle and disappear. Lady Macbeth's comes to life and grows until it drives her mad. And in the famous sleepwalking scene, she again is aware of the blood on her hands. What she said to her husband is not important. She echoes him with, "Will all the perfumes of Arabia sweeten this little hand?" She smells the blood. She cannot get it off. The blood's not there, in fact, but the blood is there in her mind, and she cannot escape it. There's that frightening sense that her conscience is haunting her soon. So we know that we have a couple of brief glimpses into the death of Elizabeth, and it was an ugly death like that. It was a mind so racked with guilt it turned on itself. The famous comment being they sent some of her priests to her. That is, ministers from her new church, the church established by her father. And when they came to offer her their comfort, she threw them out of her room in fury and screamed at them, "Do you think I do not know you are merely hedge priests?" She called them. Meaning the woman was aware at the moment of death what she had done, that these were not real priests. Imagine what must have been going through her mind at such a moment. While she was not mad, it is again that sense of the awareness that comes right at the end. Now, she didn't kill herself, but Lady Macbeth does. We learn Lady Macbeth has died by her own hand. It is the conscience that haunts her so. There's no escaping it. By the way, let me make a point. In connection with what I said at the end of this morning's talk, there is something very terrifying, not just in women who have given up their femininity, in order to violate themselves and their natural role as mother in having abortions. But what I call the Lady Macbeth complex is something that can hit them much later. They will not escape unscathed from this. I have a close friend, she and her husband, in the late 60s, learned she was pregnant. They didn't want children. It was not yet legal in this country. She flew to Mexico and had an abortion in Mexico. So this would have been about 69. It's now 25 years later, and she is non-functional. She insists she is dying. She insists she has a terrible, debilitating disease. She can no longer leave her home. She can barely walk. She has been to the doctors repeatedly who say there is nothing wrong with this woman. She is in perfect physical health. And all I can say, it's the line that the gentlewoman says to the doctor, canst thou not minister to a mind diseased? And her mind has become diseased. That guilt is absolutely overpowering her. And having killed her child, she is now quite literally convinced that her body is dying. It's not. She's in perfect health. It is a mental problem. It's not. It's a problem of conscience. It's a problem of conscience. I think we're going to be seeing more and more of these problems. More with the number of abortions. These poor women will not escape unscathed. They will carry the fact of what they have done with them. Watch for it. I will call it the Lady Macbeth syndrome. For in the female, it seems the conscience grows. Unlike Macbeth, once he starts letting blood, he keeps letting blood and becomes inured to it. And his conscience is killed. It's again a difference, a significant difference between the two sexes. It's a great difference, but it's something that I think you may be seeing. It's a terrifying possibility. I want to do something a bit out of the ordinary. I want to take some time and look at some of the actual poetry of the play. This is very technical, but at the same time I think it's extremely important in understanding the greatness of Shakespeare's accomplishment. My students have a very difficult time recognizing poetry from prose. And whenever I begin teaching the Shakespeare course and they turn in their first papers, I go through and I try to say to them, now, poetry is poetry. The way those lines are set up are important, and always the papers come in and they've just written them out as prose. It's just simply prose broken up into odd lines. And we have not grown up in a world that is conscious of poetry. We don't know what it is. We live in a prosaic age. Poetry is in and of itself a sign of the large soul of mankind. And when human beings speak poetry, they are in one sense allowing language to approach music. And music in and of itself is a kind of bridge between this world and the next. Poetry is a more spiritual form of speech. It is taking the care to arrange words perfectly, just the right words, in the right order, in order to, as I like to put it, get more miles per gallon out of each word, but also to arrange them in a pattern where the beautiful sounds, or the sounds, create meaning as well. Prose conveys meaning to us directly. It means what it says, and there can be magnificent passages of prose that sound nice, that are impressive and memorable, but poetry takes another step forward and moves us toward the beautiful, in which meaning can be found from sound as it often is in music. It's not easy to do. We don't often recognize it. What I want to do is take the most famous passage from the play and go through it a bit, looking at the verse, and try to give you a sense, not just of the greatness of idea that's in the play, because that is there, the creation of characters, the creation of plot, the insights, the ideas, but the way in which the words themselves are helping to carry that meaning. We're in Act 5, Scene 5. It's an extremely important moment. Macbeth is nearing the end. He's within the castle at Dunsinane. He is, if you will, barricading himself in this fortress, convinced of his own strength, that he cannot be overcome, when suddenly there is a cry within of women, is the stage direction. It's Shakespeare's stage direction, by the way. It says, what is that noise? Line about 10, beginning of Act 5, Scene 5. It is the cry of women, my good lord. Please notice his servant's name is Seton, S-E-Y-T-O-N. Obvious, may well be pronounced with a different vowel sound. Okay, Satan. There is a hint of that in this man that seems to be serving him for the moment. I have almost forgot the taste of fears, he says. Okay, this is the man who earlier any sound he would respond to, and his imagination would begin going. Suddenly says, I have almost forgot the taste of fears. The time has been, my senses would have cooled to hear a night shriek, and my fell of hair would at a dismal treatise rouse and stir as life were in it. I have supped full with horrors. It's an awful, awful line. A recognition that it is possible to so immerse yourself in evil, in blood, in the horrors of carnage in this world, you become inured to it. It is the danger of allowing the young to go to those hideous movies. It is the problem of watching on the news every night the body count in the major cities. If you live near a major city, you know what this is like. Every night, the list of murders. Every morning, the list of murders. Until you can't, it becomes of no meaning. There it is. I have supped full with horrors. Direness familiar to my slaughterous thoughts cannot once start me. Doesn't interest me anymore. I'm not excited about it. More blood, women crying within, no big deal. So what? His imagination is dead. Absolutely dead. Wherefore was that cry, and the news comes, the queen, my lord, is dead. Here's the great speech. The man is told his wife is dead. He says, she should have died hereafter. There would have been a time for such a word. No one's quite sure. This is one of those moments of Shakespeare at his greatest. Shakespeare being poetic. We can't say exactly what it means. She should have died hereafter may mean how thoughtless of her to die right now when there's a battle pending. She should have waited and died later. Then there would have been time. Then I might have cared. That's one possible reading. She should have died hereafter can also mean, well, she would have died eventually. There would have been a time for such a word. Doesn't matter when. Doesn't matter when. She died now? Well, she might have died a week from now. Might have died a month from now. Would have died a year from now. Doesn't matter. So what? Absolute callousness. Absolute indifference. And we launch into, as I said, the most famous speech in the play, which is quintessential nihilism. This is the passage more than anything else ever written that defines nihilism. That is, there is nothing. Nothing. Let me put some of it up here. I'll do it in black. Many of you know the speech from high school. Those of you who've read the play before in high school know the speech, right? Is it?
Okay.
Hold on, all right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Much better. Let me just put the first line down. Oh, you can see it. The sense of it is very clear. He begins by talking about time. She should have died hereafter. That is, later on. Where are we looking again? The future. The future. It's everywhere in this play. Okay? There would have been a time for such a word, and then off he goes. And this is the first, here we come. It is, if you will, Macbeth's own statement of where he is as the play ends. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps, okay? Okay, let me just take the first three lines. We once again, in the first three lines, have a vision of time. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to the last syllable of recorded time. The vantage point is again the future. But he is making, there is a recognition there. As empty as he has become, as dead as he has become, there is the sense that recorded time is going to have an end. There will be a stopping point. Okay? So he is basically saying, life will just drag out one day to the next until finally it stops. That's a prosaic statement of it. Shakespeare uses poetry. And in the poetry is getting effects that underline, in fact, create the meaning. Go back to high school English. What is the basic blank verse line composed of in terms of meter? Anybody? Anybody know? There's a name for it in poetic form. This is blank verse, which means unrhymed iambic pentameter. This is the form he's working in. What this tells us, this gives us certain information. It tells us the number of feet in a single line. That is groupings of syllables. And the rhythm of those syllables. Okay, we have a 10-syllable line, and I am is basically an unaccented syllable and an accented syllable. And we have 5 of those units in each line. It is basically short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Okay. Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Okay? We can play the game with any of Shakespeare's verse. It is ba-bum, 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 ba-bum. That's the basic meter he's working with. That is, if you will, the pulse or beat of the line. However, within each line there can be variations. And there is what we call the actual rhythm of the line, where, as with a great composer who writes a piece in three-quarter time, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, he's going to vary that rhythm. Okay? The accent is not always going to fall right on the first beat. There will be variations, and the variations are of some interest. We can play the game here with the first line and pound out the rhythm. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And there's one last, it's called, my students hate this, a feminine ending. A weak, unaccented single syllable at the end. It's called a feminine ending. The women just glare daggers at you when you say it. Because you say, it's a feminine ending, well, that means a weak ending. And they just glare at me. However, if that's the pulse, no actor would ever dare read the line like that. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Now, we can feel the pulse there. It's in the line. That's the meter. That's the pulse. That's not the rhythm of the line. The rhythm of the line is the way an actor would have to speak it. If you say it aloud, the way that a normal human being speaking would say it, something very interesting happens. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. It's not the pattern we would expect. Let me just put above it the way we pound it out. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. That that's the way, if we're just pounding it out, okay, trying to figure it out, that's not human speech. What he has done is altered the rhythm of the line, and instead of five accents, he's created a line that has how many? One, two, three. Only three. You see them? And what he has done is in between those accented syllables placed additional short syllables. So that as we read the line, what happens is, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, the thing can go on forever. And between the beats, there is this long length of time, accent-wise, and he doubles it then with the vowel. Look at the number of O's and A's in the line. To ma, and the accented syllable is what? Ma, o, a, tomorrow, and to ma. The accented vowels are all long vowels. Which means when you land on the sound, what happens? It stretches out. This line that only has three beats is about three times as long as an ordinary line. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. It is Shakespeare at his greatest. The words are doing what he's talking about. This is endless. This is endless. It's drawn out. The sense is, will this line never end? And it is Macbeth saying, will this life never end? It is an endless succession of meaningless days, okay, after days, after days. And yet, even in this line of pure nihilism, we get a tiny bit of hope. What does morrow mean? As in good morrow. What is the morrow? Anybody? If you say good morrow to someone, what are you saying? Good day, specifically morning, okay? Implying that it's not just the future, but it is, this is a night scene. This whole place takes place in the dark. Morrow suggests new dawning, new day coming, which becomes repellent to him. It's not tonight and tonight and tonight. It's morrow. And then we get, having made it through that line with the weak ending, and please notice, the great hero launches into the big speech, weak ending to start with, a sign of weakness. We land on the first, again, let me pound out the line rhythmically. Creeps in this petty pace from day to day. No one would say it that way. What is the first important word in the line that has to get an accent? Creeps. Creeps, okay? There is not another essential accent until pet. Try another one here. Not another essential. Now we're going brown. Creeps in this petty pace from day to day. And suddenly the line that begins disordered, this is called a trochee. It's an inverted iamb. The line begins, if you will, with an inversion metrically. Creeps in this petty pace from day to day. We finally get the regularity, but when we hit a regular rhythm, what he does is draw it out again. Look at what the first half of the line is saying. Creeps in this petty pace. Listen to the vowel sounds. Double E, long E, and after the long O's, it comes as a welcome relief to the ear. tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps. Creeps in this petty pace. Hear it? And suddenly we get a whole bunch of short vowels. It, eh. Before a. And it draws out again. And we, thank you. I'll just keep playing. Ooh, I like the red one. And suddenly we go from an absolutely irregular rhythm, and we get the sense of quite literally creeping, creeps, and then we get in this petty pace. And the pettiness of life is reflected again in the sound. Creeps in this petty pace from day to ma, and we're, boom, we're back in that long drawn out sound again.